These are some good counseling questions you can go through for yourself. You can go through with a buddy. Number one, do I distinguish between needs and wants? If I do, how do I define that distinction? Like, I want that versus I need that. Is it right to have a proportional relationship between what I make and what I buy? In other words, should my standard of living increase as my income increases? I don't think so. The way that Ron Sider puts it is, as you make more, you give more. And then there's a certain cap. For elders in this church, it's I think it's like $100,000. If for some reason, you know, we don't pay $100,000, but if for some reason you could work for our church part-time and be an elder, which is a non-paid position, but you're also, like, we've had medical doctors, we've had dentists as elders. But if you want to be an elder, you got to give anything over $100,000 or something like that, which is a pretty comfortable salary, I would say. I mean, you could have a nice house. You could have nice cars. You could go on vacations. You could pay for your kids' college. Why do you need to make more than that? What's the point? So many of us here are going to be making big bucks. And is it, you know, once you hit a certain point, after that point, you just say, I don't need that money. Give away. Of money spent on myself, should I make any distinctions between those things which are greater and lesser in spiritual value? For instance, a reliable car that can get me to my ministry venues versus a car with leather seats. Am I equally stable in conditions of abundance and scarcity? If not, what does this mean? How does Paul put it? I've learned to live in prosperity, also in need. But I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Do my actions show that I realize greed can lead to the destruction of my spiritual walk? Aside from normal time allotment for vacation, school, family, and sleep, where is my free time usually invested? In material and personal gain? In enjoying my possessions? Or in spiritual growth and ministry? That would be a good telling sign. Do opportunities for my spiritual and material advancement ever conflict? If they do not, what could this mean? If they do, how do I routinely choose? You know, if it comes between the things of God and the things of this world, do I always pick the things of this world? Do I ask for spiritual counsel regarding my finances, major purchases, job changes, saving, and giving plans? Is there a relationship between my answer and my view of possessions? I always ask for help. These big money decisions, you know, buying a car, what do you think? You think it's a good deal? Buying a house? Oh, yeah. I ask for input for sure. Have I demonstrated? Because what does that mean if I don't ask for input? Ask for help. It means I've got this all figured out. I don't need help from anybody. It's strange. Have I demonstrated the ability to draw the line with my job's demand of my time? Am I willing to pass up promotions or even get a different job if it conflicts with my spiritual growth and the advancement of my personal ministry? Do I have concrete short-term and long-term goals for my spiritual growth and personal ministry? If not, what does this mean? You know, everyone's got the goals for their career. They've got the goals for their workout plan, got the goals for saving, debt retirement, but they don't have goals for ministry. Do I give substantial amounts of money to God's work in a consistent way? If not, why not? Number 12, do any of these questions anger me? Why would that be the case? These are questions to discern where I'm at with this, and if I'm getting angry, that's a good sign there's an issue. Sadly, the person who wrote these questions used to be an elder at our church. And guess why he lost it spiritually? It's money. He went back into his business. He wasn't making enough teaching CTs and classes. You know, we pay a pretty fair wage, and he just was spending like crazy. He worked himself into debt. And then he decided, I'm going to go back and I'm going to quit and I'm going to take up my business. Did the business, and people talked to him and said, I think this is a bad idea. You know, let's get you out of debt. Let's get a plan. He refused. It was very sad. He was a great dude and lost it on this issue. Well, let's think of our theology of career. Okay, we're basically going through, and this is going to start to get a little bit more practical, okay? It's easy to kind of teach through the abstract principles of a theology of money and the cosmos. Now we're going to actually start to look at specifics here, okay? Career. You know, when it comes to discerning God's will on the subject of what career you should pick, it's a little bit difficult because, you know, you can't just open up the Bible and find a verse, you know, you should be a teacher, you should be a doctor, or you should whatever. And so, in some sense, Scripture is silent. You know, you can't dogmatically claim all Christians should be this or that or the other thing. On the other hand, Scripture does give not black and white, legalistic, whatever. It gives, you know, principles. And it does speak to the principles of career. So let's think of some extremes here. One extreme would be, it's ungodly to plan for our career. You know, Jesus said, do not worry about tomorrow. And he said, give all. And, you know, I shouldn't really get a career because that would be unspiritual or something. I want to live radically for God and flip burgers for the rest of my life. Okay. Well, Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. He didn't say, don't plan about tomorrow. Okay, you can plan and not worry. You know what I mean? That's different. And there's nothing spiritual about being lazy and not getting a career. There's nothing cool about that at all. God's not into that. We read through the Proverbs. You ever read through the Proverbs about the sluggard? Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. So he's sending him to nature. Look at the ant. He's just bustling constantly. It has no commander, no overseer, or ruler. It's true. Ants just do their thing. They don't need somebody on their case constantly telling them what to do. Yet the ant stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man. That's a good proverb. Lazy hands make a poor man, but diligent hands bring wealth. Work hard. The wealth of the poor is their fortified city, but poverty is the ruin of the poor. There's nothing spiritual about poverty. You know, Jesus says, blessed are the poor. Yeah, I think it's because they can see their need for God. That's for sure. He also says, blessed are the poor in spirit. That would be spiritual poverty. Luke records it, the Sermon on the Mount, it's blessed are the poor. So it's the poor. And he does say you have to give all. You have to sell everything. Come follow me. So how does that fit with getting a career? Should Christians have retirement? How does that fit with sell all? Come follow me. Well, Jesus was an itinerant preacher, wasn't he? Itinerant meaning like he would travel. So if you owned a fishing boat, let's say, and Jesus says, okay, we're traveling to Cana, or we're traveling to Galilee, or we're traveling to Jerusalem. Would it be logistically possible for you to put your fishing boat on your back and carry it with you? No. Okay. And so when Jesus says, sell all and follow me, I think he means it. I think he means, sell your possessions and follow me. I'm leaving. I'll be over there. Are you going to come? But what's interesting is when we flip over into John chapter 21, let's see, Jesus dies on Friday, right? Good Friday. He's raised on Sunday. Then he appears to Peter. And in that two-day interim, we're talking about 36 hours, Friday morning to Friday afternoon to Sunday morning, over 3 days, but 36 hours. John 21 says that Peter is on his boat fishing with John. You ever notice that? So where did he get the money for that? It could have been leave your possessions, follow me, meant leave your possessions and come follow me. Once he's done following Christ, he comes back and grabs his boat. We see a number of cases in the New Testament where they go to people's houses. So if we're to take those statements in a dogmatic way, how could anyone have a house church? How could anyone meet in Peter's mother-in-law? They meet in her house. So I don't think it's an absolute rule. I do think it means if Christ called on you to leave your stuff and pick up and go, if you're so attached to your stuff that you couldn't sell all of it, that is a sin. That's idolatry. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that every Christian should just have the shirt on their back, that sort of thing. Incidentally, I argued that with one of my professors, and she said, no, I think it really does mean sell all. And, you know, in our culture, we just think, well, when it says sell all, we make qualifications for that, and we try and make that sound right. But what if Jesus is really saying sell all? And everyone in the class was like, yeah. You know, and then I looked really stupid, you know. So I looked like the compromised Christian, you know. Then I noticed as she was sharing that story, the jewelry was ringing on her wrist. I really think this. Thought to myself. Then I took her home for, I drove her back to her hotel. And as we were driving back there, we hopped in my car. And you guys seen my car? It's not pretty. Okay. And, getting my car, and she looks at my car and she says, this is your car? She said it just like that. This is your car? And I was like, yeah, get in. So we get her in there. One of the windshield wipers had just broke because it had frozen. So I had one windshield wiper going. And the it was raining. And so I was like looking through. And then the door latch was broken. And so she couldn't get out of the car. And she's freaked out. You know, it's like, it's okay. I'll get the door for you, you know. I'm your chauffeur. Let me get it for you, you know. So I think a lot of people who really pour on the guilt here, and, you know, Jesus means give all. I mean, I think he could say that to you, and you should be willing to give all. But it's a lot of double talk. People say, yeah, it means give all. Okay, why do you have a $200,000 house? Well, I downgraded to an $80,000 house. Okay, why do you have an $80,000 house? You know, if it really means give all, that means give all. So that's how I harmonize that. That was a tangent. Proverbs 12:24. Diligent hands will rule, but laziness ends in slave labor. The lazy man doesn't roast his game, but the diligent man prizes his possessions. The sluggard craves and gets nothing, but the desires of the diligent are fully satisfied. Lazy people always wanting more, but they don't work, and so they don't get it. Dishonest money dwindles away, but he who gathers money little by little makes it grow. Good passage on saving, having a savings account. All hard work brings a profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. Remember working with this dude? He was 30. He would deliver pizzas. We're working with him. I'm like, dude, do you want a family? Do you want to have kids? Do you want your wife to be able to stay home? Do you want to have health insurance for when you get married and fall in love and have a baby? You know, what's your plan here?
And so he said, well, I'm going to go down to the college, and I'm going to get into this program, and I'm going to get this medical thing, a two-year degree. I'm like, that's a good start. That's good, you know. And so I met up with one of his old home church leaders, and he said, how's my buddy doing? And I said, oh, he's doing pretty good. He's going to get into this program, you know. The guy looked at me. He said, has he put any money down? I said, no, but he drove down there. He said, so he went down and talked to a counselor, but he didn't. Has he, like, paid for anything? Well, no, but it starts, like, a month from now, and, you know, he'll pay when he gets there. Like, an application form? Has he done anything like that? No. So he said, he's done that probably 15 to 20 times. We'll put pressure on him and say, dude, you got to get a career, do something, and he'll go. And it's just like this proverb, you know, mere talk leads to poverty. What are you doing with your life? Well, I'm going to go do this thing. And I'm going to get into this program, or I'm going to get this trade, or I'm going to go to school. And they never actually do it. They don't actually ever do it. Yeah, we got to urge people. You got to take action. Let's get this started. It's too late. It's too late when you're in your 30s. Let's get it done now. Get some kind of a trade or education. The way of the sluggard is blocked with thorns, but the path of the upright is a highway. Laziness brings on deep sleep, and the shiftless man goes hungry. Lazy people are always wanting to sleep all the time. What'd you do? Slept for 12 hours? Why are you going for a nap? Oh, tired, you know. Don't love sleep or you will grow poor. Stay awake and you will have food to spare. Yeah, same one. Okay, you guys getting the picture here? Oh, here's my favorite. We used to read these, by the way, to my buddy. He would sleep in until 11 o'clock at the house. And so we would just open up our Bible. We had them highlighted. And so we would just go in and be like, oh, the sluggard says. There is a lion in the road, a fierce lion roaming the streets. Yeah, I don't want to go outside. There's about to be a lion out there. I don't want to go to work. Too much snow out there, you know. That's raining. I have irritable bowel congestion. I can't do that, you know. As a door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard turns on his bed. What a great problem. You like that noise of the hinge? So it's like in their bed. Moaning. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He's too lazy to bring it back to his mouth. Just picture the potato chips all just, too lazy to even curl that potato chip. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who answer discreetly. Yeah. So, nothing spiritual about laziness, not getting a career. We know that God calls people from all different classes, races, and walks of life, right? Paul says, not many noble, not many wealthy, not many rich, not many wise. Whatever your theology of career is, it needs to work as well for the rice farmer in Cambodia, as well as for the doctor in the United States. So any kind of theology of career that extols one kind of career over another, and, you know, says, well, those are unskilled labor, so that's not as important, that's surely unbiblical, because we're all one body. So whatever we come up with here, and this is a complicated subject, and I don't know if you've ever thought through this, what should be a theology of career has to be able to account from people from lower incomes, for sure. However, to voluntarily live in poverty, you know, just to completely piss away your teens and 20s and not get a career, what is that? That is wrong. That is sinful. You have the opportunity. You're given the opportunity. 2 Thess 3:10, Paul says, for even when we were with you, we gave you this order. If anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. No, you shouldn't even feed somebody. Now, somebody who's poor, disabled, remember going through Cambodia, you know, there were just people who were physically crippled. No arms. How are they supposed to work? You feed those people. I mean,
I'm not really sure what they can do. People here, you know, a 20-something-year-old man, you know, with two arms and two legs who won't get a career. No. 1 Thess 4:11. Lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands. 1 Timothy 5:8. If you don't provide for your own, he's denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever. And some people just can't connect the dots here. They don't see, if I don't work now, I'm going to be in trouble later. I was working with one dude a couple years back. It was like, okay, you know, you're going to fall in love, and you're going to love this girl, and you're going to want to get married, and then you're going to have to sit down with her father. And he's going to say, so what do you do? And you're going to say, you know, delivering pizzas or flipping burgers. And he's going to say, how are you going to provide for a family? And I'm like, dude, this could not be that far off. It could happen relatively soon. And you need to get that crap in order. You got to get into school. You got to get something. Perpetually working in minimum wage jobs will cause problems down the road. For one, you're easily victimized by your boss. If you work an unskilled job, bosses can hire and fire you. They used to tell us, they used to like me when I worked at restaurants and stuff, but they would threaten the other people. Hey, I got a stack of applications this big back there, buddy. Got 100 people that would take your job. Trying to retire on a minimum wage salary will never happen. You could be laid off later in life. Because a younger worker can fill your unskilled job. You might think, well, I'm really good at this job. Not really. Somebody else could jump right in. 3-6 months, they could be right where you are. Have people working minimum wage have a difficult time providing for a family on their income? They might actually have to work, you know, 70, 80, 90 hours a week. Be completely uninvolved in ministry just because they got to pay for the bills, take care of the family. I think at that point, I mean, they'd be in a real pickle. What do I do? Do I surrender my walk with God, or do I provide for my family? We should never put ourselves in that situation. They can lose the freedom to choose their own hours, you know, where the boss is like, you got to work second shift. And so it's like, I don't want to work second shift. You have to work second shift. You don't have any kind of rights. And if you're in this situation, you're unable to give to the cause of Christ. You know, you don't have anything left over to give. The Bible teaches that the purpose of our career is to have money to provide for our own needs and then have enough to share with others. Ephesians 4:28. Teach him to steal no longer. Why? So that he can become a giver. So I like to make these points with people who just refuse to get a career of some kind. Solomon writes, give me neither poverty nor riches. Riches. Proverbs 30, verse 8. So he doesn't want poverty. He also doesn't want riches. That'd be the other side of things. Okay, what about this proposition? My career is my calling or my ministry. You ever heard this? I got a calling to be a fill in the blank. I think you found your calling. Where does this idea come from? In a recent interview, theologian J.I. Packer states, the word vocation, the etymology of that term, vocation, means calling. And right at the heart of vocation is, I believe, in every case, the sense that God has called one to do what one is doing. The sense of being called comes out of thinking and praying about what one has been gifted in and so fitted to do, and which of the options for life activity is the best one. And so that's kind of the perspective. This is really, it's a hangover from Roman Catholicism, where they didn't really teach the world system. Okay, they believed in Christendom, where, you know, the king was Christian, and the Pope was in with the king, and the whole land was Christian. And so if everyone's a Christian and we live in Christendom, what are we supposed to do with our lives? Well, Roman Catholicism taught, you know, your job is your ministry. So if you're a shoe cobbler, that is your ministry. You make shoes for the glory of God. Okay? Now, Reformed teaching really just took this over without any kind of critique of it. So that's where we get this whole concept of vocation. Or you missed your calling. I mean, I use that term all the time, you know. I missed my calling. I should have been a weatherman because I love the weather. That sort of thing. But Paul, the New Testament, never gives career advice except for the fact that we work hard at our career. It's the only thing it says. I worked hard among you, 2 Thess 3:8. Or that we should live a quiet life and work with our hands, 1 Thessalonians 4:11. So if we're basing it off of the dogmatic teaching of Scripture, I guess that would leave us with manual labor, working with your hands. I don't think it should be dogmatic in that sense, but the calling that my career is my calling, okay, the problem with that, if you adopt that teaching, is that going to work would fulfill your ministry for the week. That I show up to work, I would rather say, I go to my job to do ministry, rather than to say my job is my ministry. You see the difference? So if I'm working with people at work, I can share my faith. I can counsel. I can serve. I can have a positive attitude. I can get up early. I can cover people's shifts. I can be a good witness for Christ. But to say, you know, imagine that you're working for Honda, okay? And you screw in bolts into the side of a car. You know, every day you screw in 3,000 bolts. So the car comes down the line. Zzz, zzz, zzz. Next car. Zzz, zzz, zzz. Are we to say that's our ministry? That, you know, I got to screw these bolts in and I do that for the glory of God? I remember watching one of those videos of OSU players who were Christians, and they had their testimonies, and it was kind of like this evangelistic DVD passed out to people. You know, Trestle was on there, and all the great Buckeye players and stuff, and it was cool. I mean, and they'd share how they loved Christ and stuff, and it was awesome. Then one of the players made the comment in this particular video where he was like, you know, everything I do is for Christ. I was like, cool. And he's like, you know, catching that football, every time I catch that football, I do it for the glory of God. And when I practice, I do it for the glory of God. And when I catch that touchdown, I do it for the glory of God. And I started thinking about that, and it sounded really cool. Like, he was like, you know, it's not about me, it's about Christ, and I like that. But then I started thinking, like, what is the way that you catch the football that looks any different from a non-Christian catching a football? Or making a tackle, or getting a touchdown. Like if I didn't know you were a Christian, could I look at the film reel and be like, oh, that guy's doing it for the glory of God for sure. You know, or that one, well, that was pretty non-glorifying God, that touchdown pass. You know what I mean? Now, if it was that player after the game doing ministry in a locker room, I could see that was for the glory of God. I'd be able to say, well, that's a believer and that's a non-believer. So this whole idea that our, that's kind of a side point, but the whole idea that our job is our ministry, it just strikes me as strange. I'd rather say we do ministry on our job. Now, one passage that has come up, and I found pretty interesting that the elders were discussing this whole topic, Colossians 3:23, do your work heartily So this would be your job, your career. Do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men. It is the Lord whom you serve. And so this would mean, you know, you show up to work and your boss is a kind of a jerk and he's selfish and he's kind of incompetent like every boss is. Yet you still work and you have that attitude. I'm not working for you. I know that my work ethic here will actually honor Christ. That my boss will see me and see my life and see that I work hard and see I don't grumble or complain and I work as hard as I can, and he'll see that. And it's like you show up and it's like Jesus hands you the shovel. And you're like, what should I do? And he's like, you know, dig this ditch. And you're like, yes, sir. What should I do? Well, screw in these bolts in this car. 2,000 volts. And you screw those bolts in as good as you can. It's not that the bolts matter. It's that this is an attitude of submission, that I'm showing up to work hard and make an impact for Christ while I'm here. And part of that is through my work ethic. All that you do, do for the glory of God. So I think there's a sense in which when you're showing up to do your job, yeah, that's part of your Christian walk too. Mostly, it's we've had cases where the boss will get a bunch of people from our church, and then they'll just be like, we want more. These people are so good. At our job, it was that way. Me and my buddy Chris worked there. We would show up at 7 o'clock with our teeth brushed, shaven, you know, our hair combed. We were parking cars, valets. We weren't hungover. We weren't stoned. We ran to the cars, and our boss was just like, you got any more friends like you? We were like, yeah, plenty. We filled that whole place. Then it got to the point where there wasn't too many people to witness to, so that kind of sucked. But having a good attitude at work, this would include not stealing from your job. That was a real dark spot on my walk there. Got caught stealing money. It was tips. It was tips from the next crew. So I got off at 3, collected a bunch of tips that really belonged to those guys. Got a phone call. I was after home church. It's in home church. Got a phone call. Yeah, you took our money. You got our money. I know it was you. You got it. And he left like 4 voicemails, and each one was angrier. So I was listening. I was embarrassed. Had 80 bucks or so in my wallet. I drove right down after home church, showed up. Jason was the shift supervisor. Showed up with the money in hand. And right when he saw me, it was kind of like, uh-oh, maybe he's upset that I cussed him out on the voicemail, you know. He saw me show up, and it was kind of like, whoa, what are you doing here, you know. So I showed up, I pulled the money out, I handed it to him, and he was just like, whoa. And I was like, yeah, you're right, I messed up. And he was like, he kind of looked like it had the Ebola virus on it, you know, like, I don't want to touch that. And he wouldn't take the money, so eventually I just put it down on the table and said, you know, I screwed up, I'm sorry, I stole. So I think if you do steal, you do screw up, it's a good idea. That's an opportunity to go back and say, I messed up and apologize, you know. How many workers will do that in the world? Even that, even God can use that where you're sinning and screwing up. It's a good witness too. So, one point about Colossians 3:23 I think is interesting is the fact that some people use this to do your work heartily as for the Lord, and so they use this as a verse to get a high-powered career. That's not what this verse is talking about. Who's this verse given to? Do you know? Slaves. Christian slaves. What should you do? What should you do if you're in slavery? Work hard. If you can get your freedom, take it. But that's not what this is talking about. What about this proposition? If I have a high-powered career, I can be more influential for God. You know, like I want to go and take over a business because if I'm a Christian businessman,
that I'll be able to influence all my employees. Being a politician, being an actor, being a whatever, okay? Why would that be the approach? Okay, I suppose it's theoretically possible that believers in places of social influence can have a big impact for Christ. Okay, this is, of course, presuming you don't drag Christ's name through the mud. Like, who is that? Tim Tebow. Oh, man, he came out and he announced, you know, he's a good-looking dude, looks like a male model, great arm, and he's a Bible-believing evangelical Christian. And he came out in front of the press and he said, I've never had sex with a woman. I'm saving myself for marriage. And no floozy came forward and said, he's lying. I mean, that took some serious guts. I think he was telling the truth. And right when he said that, made that statement, I was, first of all, impressed by the integrity. But when he made that statement, all I could think of was, please don't sleep with a girl. The temptation you would go through as a hotshot quarterback, oh, my God. I mean, I was worried for him, you know, that, and so far he's done pretty good, and I'm happy about that. But, so supposing you've got incredible integrity, I could not have that kind of integrity in this situation. I'll just say that. That would be very, very difficult to imagine. But supposing you do, which would be awesome, thinking about this perspective that we're going to go to the upper echelons of culture and then we're going to take over for Christ and that will have a top-down, trickle-down effect where everyone becomes Christians. Okay, that strategy seems like a good strategy. What's suspicious about it is that we don't see anything like this in Scripture. We don't have any inkling that this is the way we should go. Now, we've got a few examples of people that were definitely used by God in positions of power. One would be Paul. Okay, he was wealthy, he was educated, and so God called him in this situation, right? He was a Pharisee under Gamaliel. He was a rabbi, he could go into synagogues. He used his Roman citizenship to get out of persecution. I was just reading my personal time, I'm doing Philippians. And so I was doing the background work, Acts 16, where he starts the church. And I was noticing, you know, that they come to mess him up, and he says, I'm a Roman citizen. So I think if we can use leverage for Christ, we should use it in an appropriate way. Nothing wrong with that. But here's what's interesting. If you think Paul should be the example of why we should move into the high-powered career or whatever, why is it that Paul calls all of that dung in Philippians 3. Why is it that he voluntarily steps out of that role? Why is it that he becomes a tent maker? He took a trade job. If this strategy was so good, why isn't it that Paul didn't go back to the Sanhedrin and say, boy, if we could just reach the whole Sanhedrin, we could reach the whole nation? I mean, that strategy seems to make sense. That just wasn't his approach. Daniel was in a position of political prowess, for sure. But he was forced into this situation. You know, the Babylonian government took him as a slave with his three buddies. He didn't aspire to this situation, but he was in it. And I think if you're in the situation, you use it, right? He used his position of influence, for sure. And I think if you're in a position of power or prestige or whatever, staying in the position in which you were called, I think that's totally appropriate. And be a light for Christ in that situation. But aspiring to that situation, I think, is different. Esther would be a third example. She rescued the Jewish people in the Persian court. But again, God placed her here. Was it Xerxes? Is Esther? I haven't read Esther for about a year or two. Yeah, I think it's Xerxes, the Persian king. He brings her in as one of the hot Jewish babes. It's not like she was trying to get into that role. She was called into that role. Okay, if this strategy is so good, why is it that when Jesus prays to pick his disciples, he picks, according to Acts 4:13, uneducated and untrained men? Wouldn't you think if this was such a good strategy to hit the top-down approach and you go after the politicians and the entertainers and then we'll reach them and then the whole nation will become Christian? If that was such a good idea, why doesn't he go to the Sanhedrin and reach those guys, pick those guys as his disciples? Paul says God called not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble. Now, of course, he doesn't say not any wise, not any mighty, not any noble. And I think God does call those people. And that's great, obviously. You think of William Wilberforce, C.S. Lewis. Just think of the great good both of those men did. A Wilberforce and slavery in Great Britain. You know, historians call that econocide. You know, suicide, killing yourself. Econocide. Wilberforce taking down the British Parliament in the 18th century, 19th century, was econocide. It killed the economy, but it was the right thing to do. Think of C.S. Lewis, what a light for the gospel he was. And so on and so forth. You can think of many examples. But in both of those examples, which are great examples, those guys were called when they were in that position. You know, C.S. Lewis came to Christ as an Oxford professor. And what do you do if you're in that role? You live a life for Christ. You be the salt and light to the culture. Paul says that Christians should stay in the condition in which they were called. So, what was Jesus' method? What was Paul's method? It was to make not a top-down approach, but a bottom-up approach, where you quietly disciple people, and then they disciple other people, and this has this ripple effect that it turned the first century world on its head. In fact, when people sense that this is coming from the top down, major problems. It atrophies spirituality. Look at the church in Britain. There was the state church. And people in Europe are less Christian today than they've ever been. So, we shouldn't be naive over the dangers of pursuing a high-powered career. The Bible warns us what happens to believers who desire to be rich. So, as we're choosing our career, we should consider, are we ready to withstand the incredible temptation of making so much money? I mean, that is going to be very, very difficult. It's not desirable, and it's spiritually dangerous. Moreover, what will it take to reach a place of stability in the career of our choice? You know, many high-powered careers demand years or even decades to complete, which is okay, that's fine, but are you going to have to totally put God on the sidetrack for a decade? And for what? It's for this career. And so, why? Well, it's because that career will eventually make an impact for God. That's dangerous, too. How do you know by the time you get there, you'll still be following God? So, you know, any kind of path you want to choose that basically puts God, your family, your friends, and the people of God in second place, that is a mistake. I remember one of my buddies is an attorney, and so he came to Christ when I think he was like in his 30s. Real sharp, good-looking dude. He's in his 50s now, still a good-looking guy, a real sharp attorney, and he was trying to make practice, make partner in his practice, and the current partner approached him and called him in, and he had just come to Christ a couple years earlier,
He started leading a home church. His marriage was coming back together. His kids were doing well. And he was starting to feel kind of that tension, you know. And so his boss started to notice it too. His boss showed up, called him in, had a private conversation, closed the door. He said, so-and-so. He said, you know, I've been starting to notice that your priorities aren't really lined up with this firm. And so my buddy, John, was like, well, you know, I think you're kind of right. You know, like my priorities are God first, and my family second, and my church third, and, you know, I mean, maybe this firm fourth or fifth. And so the partner leaned in and looked him dead in the eye, and he said, well, we want, I think, the second priority on that list, and maybe even the first, if you want to make partner here. You know, there was just a certain point where he was just like, I'm out of here. Can't do that. To make such a sacrifice, and for what? What is the point? That I need to be some big hotshot for this law firm? He took a different role in a different firm. If you go over to his house, his kids are not missing too many meals. Okay, he's in good shape, big giver, and he does not regret it. Paul commands us, let us not give up meeting together, Hebrews 10:25. And so I'm going to go for X, whatever X is, but it violates that I can be a part of fellowship in a dedicated way. It violates me being able to be close with God daily. Whatever X is, I don't care what X is, this is a universally binding moral command. Meeting together with the people of God. Paul warns, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time because the days are evil. So this is wisdom. This isn't a, I've had people try and pin me on this and be like, so which careers are wrong? And how much money is too much? And that's where you get into legalism, where you're starting to say it's this and not that. Making this much is wrong. You can't do that. It doesn't say that. So that's definitely exceeding what's written. So this is a wisdom principle. It's the principle that our time here is really short. It's going to be over relatively soon. And Paul says, make the most of your time. And so to say, I'm going to give up 10 years of my life to be out of fellowship and pursue this career. No, that is an unwise, I would definitely have a critique of that, for sure. What about this proposition? Well, I have a high IQ, and it would be a bad stewardship to not use it to the best of my potential. I've heard that before. People would be like, well, you know, my kid's really smart, and if he doesn't get a high-power career, it's like, you know, why would God give him that brain if he doesn't use it? Okay, stewardship always, always, always refers to our stewardship toward the cause of Christ. It doesn't refer to personal success, getting a high-power career. Think of 1 Peter 4:10. The stewardship God has given to you. You think of the parable of the talents, where you show up and he judges the talents. The talents don't refer to how many businesses we made or something like that. God's going to come back and be like, what can I do with that? That doesn't help at all. Jesus said, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth. So that would be a sin, living your life to build up treasure. That's wrong. And he warned of the man who stores up treasures for himself and is not rich toward God. Well, by way of conclusion for this section, our theology of career should not be within the realm of spiritual authority. You know what I mean by that? Leaders, Christian leaders, what realm of authority do they have? Spiritual authority. So if things are mentioned in Scripture, you can have authority over that. Yeah, this needs to stop. When we have our Bible study, what time, where, whose house, who gets to become a leader, who teaches, that's all within the realm of spiritual authority. Now, who you date, who you decide to date, is that ever mentioned in the Bible? No. What house you buy, where you live, what career you choose. I mean, we can't authoritatively come in and say you can or can't do that. That's exceeding what's written. But we can argue our case, and we can counsel, and we can plead. But at the end of the day, people are adults, and it's their choice. And, you know, I usually tell people, you know, here's my thought. I think this is a terrible idea, and here's why. But you're an adult, and you make your bed, and then you get to sleep in it. A good rule of thumb is, who suffers from this decision, me or them? Okay? And if it's them, that's their choice. Dating, you know, you're going to date this person who's not a Christian, promiscuous. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea. I think that's foolish, but it's your choice. You know, I can't tell you who to date. And so this is kind of that way. My thought is, if I'm going to make a decision for my career that's going to impact the rest of my life, my family, everybody, I mean, I would want to get some counsel and some help to kind of get some assistance here. Well, there's a couple papers if you're looking to do some more reading. Our elders have been thinking through this for the last couple of years. This is Applied Ethics, Theology of Career. It's complicated, but those are some propositions, Christ, Culture, and Career, that we wrote up there. Then also Trusting God with Big Decisions. Okay. Boy, I'd like to pause. Let me just push through. Is that cool? We'll take questions. Okay. Simple Living, The Positive Picture. I'm really into this. Living simply, I think this is the biblical view. This is where you get a career. It has benefits. It's relatively stable. Something that can provide for a wife if you decide to have kids. So I'm thinking 30s, 30. Maybe if you start your career in the 30s, that's cool. But you'd be living pretty lean, providing for a couple kids and spouse. I'm thinking at least in the 40s, okay, somewhere in there. And I'm sure in 5 years I'll have to come back and say it's different. But for now, you could probably make do, although 50s or 60s would be better. I mean, I'm just trying to talk practically now, or more. To live simply, stay out of credit card debt. Look at this. This is from the Business Insider. Credit card debt, affluenza. You see that line at the bottom? That is median household income growth. Since 1980, it's doubled, tripled. You know, from 100% up to, 300%. Look at the credit card debt per household. It is 1,200% larger. So have you ever seen that SNL skit about how to get your finances in order? I think it's Steve Martin. Like, what do you do? And he's holding his video like he's an infomercial, you know. He's like, yeah, it's called Don't Buy Things You Can't Pay For. And then they're like, can I buy this car? Do you have the money? No. Then don't buy it. Just go back and forth. It's really funny. And it's really true, too. Here's affluenza. If you spend $2,000 on a typical credit card at 18% interest, and you make the minimum payments to pay it off, it will take you 11 years, and you will end up paying double the original price. $2,000. Americans now only save 0.2% of their personal income, about $1.50 a week, on a salary of $40,000. I saved more when I was getting an allowance, my friends. Buck 50. Europe, I guess, is better. Michael Jackson. Did you ever see that video after he died? They were showing what his house looked like. He was $61 million in debt when he died. Overdosed on pills. I'm wrong about that. Yet after selling more than... I was just glancing at my notes. I got the wrong figure. Yet after selling more than 61 million albums, the King of Pop died Thursday at age 50, reportedly awash in $400 million in debt. And they showed this footage of it where he'd show up and he'd go into some ritzy rug place and, you know, there'd be some rug and he'd be like, oh, yes, I must have it. I must have it. Yeah, buy it. And the interviewer was like talking to his manager. How much was that? $200,000, you know, Venetian French rug or something. He was in debt. A lot of people are that way too. They just can't stop the spending. Bible speaks against debt. I know Alcorn is really against debt. I'm not that against it. I think it's okay. You go into debt for school, for house. Like the Muslim faith is against debt completely. You cannot be in debt. And so you stay with your parents until you have enough money to buy a house. Many families. Debt leads to anxiety, stress. There was a recent story I heard of a Christian couple in our fellowship. And they were talking about their kid. They were urging their kid toward all these scholarships and performance and academia. Real hardcore. And so we talked to them and we're trying to counsel them. And it came out that the couple makes $200,000 a year, their net income. And so we were like, okay, you're riding your kid toward scholarships and sports to get a sports scholarship and all this. And we were like, so why don't you just pay for their school? You guys make almost $250,000 a year. They're like, we can't. We're like, why not? Because they're like, we're $50,000 in debt, credit card debt. And so they're driving the kid to perform when they had the money. There was a New York Times article recently of all these traveling sports leagues. I don't know if you caught that. It was in a couple years ago. But these sports leagues would move around, and it was like a racket, where the coaches would get the parents to spend money and be on these traveling leagues all over the world. And the coaches would tell the parents, yeah, I think your kid is just, you know, he's like Pele, you know, he's like Jordan. He could be a pro. And so they would convince the parents, my kid is awesome. They'd get on these traveling leagues, spend thousands of dollars taking their kid all over the country. And then it turns out, you know, how many kids go pro? Not that many. Well, the article, New York Times, it concluded, it was really funny. It said, you know, that $10,000 per year on traveling leagues, if you had saved that, that could have covered their whole college tuition and then some, and their house payment, you know. So getting out of debt, what is it, 2 Corinthians 12:14? It isn't the responsibility of the kids to save for the parents, but the parents to save for the kids. Yeah, when you get kids, putting aside some money for college so their kid doesn't have to worry about their school. Wouldn't that be cool? Car debt, almost as worse as credit card debt. You get a $3,000 car, brand new. You drive it off the lot. How much is it worth? You drive it 10 feet off the lot. You sign the paper. It's 30 grand. How much is it worth now? Loses 10% the second, 30 seconds after you drive it off the lot, loses 10%. So now it's at $27,000. You ever heard of gap insurance for new cars? That's where you get a new car, and they're like, okay, here's the insurance. You want gap insurance? What's gap insurance? Well, that's the gap of what you paid and then what it's actually worth now that you bought it. And so the gap insurance covers you that $3,000 right off the start. I had a buddy who bought a brand new truck, wrecked it within 6 months. He was a drunk, but wrecked it, and he bought the gap insurance, so they totally covered the truck. Okay, let's think. You drive that car for 5 years. Let's say low depreciation. So you really treat it well, get your oil changes, you do well. That car is now worth $16,000, about half the price. So talk about depreciation of an investment. It's not like a house. You know, a house, you give money toward, and it appreciates in value. You do work to it, and the neighborhood gets better. Cars depreciate. Now, in Cambodia, there's such a demand for cars because they're building roads so quickly that there's such high demand and low supply that you can buy a car, run it, and it appreciates in value in Cambodia. So if you're in Cambodia, a car would be a good investment. Not so much in America. College debt. I know a lot of people who are freaked out over college debt. It's not that bad. Okay. Percentage. Now, private loans, bad. Really bad. They will really hit you. You know, federal loans, pretty good. The percentage is really low. Also, you can take a pretty long time to pay them off. You can do it over, like we do, minimum payments, because we don't need the money. I mean, it's more money over time, for sure, if you do the minimum payments. But we don't need the money when we're 50. By then, we're going to be making money hand over fist. My wife will be back at work. I'll be a 50-year-old man working my job. You make more. So we'll have the money then. We need the money now. Okay. I'm 30, almost 31. Wait, did I turn 31? No, that's this Sunday. Just if you get me something, keep it under like 50 bucks, okay? But, you know, now I'm 30, I'm young, not making as much money. My wife's staying at home with her son. So making minimum payment, not that bad. Now, our private loan, we are aggressively going after that because that will mess you over, having a big private loan. We got about $5,000. We also screwed up because I'm $30,000 in debt. She's $50,000 in debt, student debt. And I was an English major, and she was a psych major. Stupid. Ugh. I always said, I got my English major now, so that and $1.50 buys me a cup of coffee, you know. God ended up using it because I do a ton of writing these days. But, you know, pick a practical degree. Pick something where, you know, you can get a job, you can get hired, you can make money. A lot of my buddies and stuff, we're always talking philosophy all the time. So they're like, I want to be a philosophy major. I'm like, no, don't do that. You're going to be philosophizing flipping burgers, okay? So college debt, not that bad, but I'll tell you what, good rule of thumb. Take out as much college debt as you make in your first year of that career. So let's say you're a registered nurse, you're an RN, and you make $40,000 in your first year. Take out $40,000 of college loans or less, okay? One girl we counseled was her undergraduate was, what was it? She was a French major, went to a private school and racked up $100,000 in debt with a French degree. And now she's doing massage therapy because she couldn't get a job. What do you do with a French major degree? I don't even know what that is. She couldn't get a job, and she was like, I can't work with this degree. I have $100,000 in debt. She started doing being a masseuse or a masseur.
So do something. I really wish somebody had told me that. I graduated college and got a job at working in school. But I thought, they told me when I went to college, all the businesses want English majors. They all want psych majors, these humanities degrees. No. And that could change. So again, I don't want to be dogmatic that it's whatever. But the whole point is, get into a degree you can actually get a job with. Please. House debt. Not that bad, I will say. If you get a house, let's say you get a $100,000 house at a pretty standard rate, and you go on the 30-year plan, 30-year mortgage plan, how much will you eventually pay on that house in 30 years? So if you paid cash, it would be $100,000, right? But with interest over 30 years, you know how much that house cost you? $300,000. So it's triple if you do a 30-year mortgage. Now, for me, I've got the small mortgage because I'm doing the 30-year plan. I'm not trying to aggressively knock out that debt. I don't really care. When I'm 50 and I'm making money hand over fist and my wife is working, we'll knock out that mortgage and then we'll, you know, whatever. But at this point, not that big of a deal. You can go on the minimum rate and that's fine. I mean, it's not advantageous financially, but I feel like for young parents, don't worry about your debt. Based on one income, so a lot of people buy a house and, you know, how much is the house? Well, $200,000. You guys can afford that? Oh, yeah, we're pre-approved, you know. Can you afford that on one income? Maybe. I don't know. How much is your mortgage? You know, $1,500 a month. How are you going to pay that? So basically what you're doing is you're putting yourself in a situation that you're locking yourself up, okay? That means I can't let my wife stay home with the kid. I gotta have her working, which means I gotta throw my kid in daycare. And well, did I leave that little hyperlink on there? Servant team meeting 2012. The elders at the time rolled out copious statistics and information on just how important it is to have your kid home with mom those first 5-6 years. It's not a 50s hangover. It's not, you know, a John Wayne BS thing. There is a value to having a parent home with the kid, and shipping them off to daycare does affect the kid, okay? I don't care how good the daycare is. No one is going to love that kid the way you love your kid. A lot of the bonding, affection. Okay, here's the point. They did a study, okay? 40 mothers. Their kids had been out of the womb for 24 to 48 hours, okay? So brand new mothers, brand new babies, right? They went in and recorded all of the screams and the crying of the 40 babies, newborn babies, right? Wah, 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 you know, all the different screams. They played the 40 screams to the 40 different mothers. Each mother could identify the scream of her baby 100%. There's something strange going on there, okay? I don't think we have it all figured out. But it's good for kids, and you know, we're scraping to do it. We're scraping by. We might even have to go into debt. I'm not sure. We're doing pretty good at this point. We plan pretty good, but even if we did, okay, going into debt for 5, 6, 7 years, I would be totally okay with that, for sure. Listen to that teaching. They go over the research on it. It's incredible. So, dad could stay home too. I guess that's okay, too. Got couples doing that. Probably better if mom stays home. Mostly because I know I'm just all thumbs with the kid. The kid doesn't want me, man. I put in 2 hours a day with my son and then family day. So I spend a lot of time with him, more than probably most dads, but he still wants her. He wants mom. They also do this thing where they put kids on the mother. They call it the mother's topless and the kids naked. What do they call it? I can't remember. But it's like a thing of bonding. It's real popular. No. It's called something else. What is it? Skin to skin. Yeah, skin to skin. Okay, so with mothers, when they put the baby up on the chest of the mother's temperature regulates for the baby. And so if the baby's really hot, she changes to be cool. If he's really cold, she changes to be warm. You know, they did the same study with fathers, and it was like putting them in an oven. Like a furnace. So listen to that teaching. It's really good. And Dan gave a whole parenting class where he made a case for it. I'm convinced. You know, that time's going to be over really quick, really soon. And you don't regret the time you spent with your kids when they're growing up. You do regret the fact that you shipped them off. So when you get a house, consider geography. A buddy of mine was buying a house. We didn't know. We never thought through any of this kind of stuff. And so, you know, he bought a house up in Westerville. Good price and good school system and et cetera, et cetera. Then it kind of turned into week after week after week after year, people don't want to drive up to Westerville. And I know you're pulling your hair out. If you own a house up there, you're like, guys, it's 12 minutes of a drive, okay? It's not bad. Just you hop on 71, you get off, and we're right around the corner. It's not far, but there's something psychological that people don't drive 10, 15 minutes away. When you're sitting at home in your house 10 or 15 minutes away, and someone says, hey, come over, let's hang out, you just think, I don't know, it's a 10 or 15-minute drive. So the best success we've seen is that geography matters. And the closer we can be with people, it has an effect, for sure. My buddy's actually thinking about selling his house and coming back down to live by me. That'd be pretty fun. But, you know, we didn't know. We didn't know at the time that that even was a consideration. I just thought, you know, we'd hop in a car and go up there. It sounded fun. Using your house for hospitality, yeah. Okay, practical steps in 2 minutes. Buy a reliable used car. That's usually pretty good. 5 years old, not bad. Saving so you can pay cash. So you buy, let's say you go buy your car. Then you start a savings account where you put away $100 a month for your next car. And so you save, and maybe that car lasts you 5, 10 years. By the time you're ready to buy that next car, you've got a nice bank account. You don't need to get a loan. You can just pay for it cash. Fixing your car is often cheaper than getting a new car. You know, a lot of times people hit the panic button, and they're like, God, this car, oh, now the thing's broke. And the transmission, and you know, yeah, I mean, it is going to cost you $1,200 for that transmission, or it's going to cost you $2,000 for an engine. At that point, you might consider getting a new car. But fixing little things, you always have to weigh it against the cost of a car payment. You know, would it be better just to fix it and keep it running, or to buy a $10,000 car where I have a big payment? I like to advocate an emergency fund, having money put away. Proverbs talk about saving, yeah. Reducing your spending below your means. When your buddies are going out to eat, you go with them and you get a Coke, okay? You eat at home. Going out to get a beer, you go out and you get that PBR, maybe. You want to be social. Then you come home and you pour yourself a glass of scotch, you know. So not spending as much as others
Pay off credit cards. Yeah, we talked about that. Practice long-term saving and investing habits. Giving. Getting some goals for giving. Getting some good savings. I like to have a little savings account in case something real drastic happens, either for myself or a friend. That someone's like, hey, she's in the hospital, we're in debt, and you can fork out a couple thousand. How cool is that? Have a little savings. Or, you know, your car falls apart and you're not in a total dilemma. You got the money put aside that you can spend for that. So, if only we could cut down our spending and increase our giving and increase our savings and just live simply. What a sweet picture. Be power givers, good savers, and just not waste money on our greed. Be a lot more stable. Buying things used, and for me it's kind of a game that you can go to the thrift store and get stuff used. I don't really have that much sense of fashion either, so but other people do. They go to the thrift store and get great stuff. So, also, pray before you buy something. You'll be like, I really want that car seat. I really want that thing. And you start to pray, God, we pray you give us a blank. We prayed for a big screen TV. We did. And we were kind of half joking, you know, because it was like our TV was like 24 inches, like a monitor. We had this big place to put a TV, and then we had this little TV on top. It looked really stupid, and we were just like, God, we got some money for buying a house from our in-laws and parents. We're like, God, let's just spend, you know, $600-700, get a sweet TV. We'll have it for the rest of our lives, you know. We're like, nah, no. We guys bought a house. We need the money, and we got a kid. And so we started praying, you know, God, can you just give us, like, a decent TV? And so the one day, Herney calls me. She's like, hey, I got this extra flat screen TV. Do you want it? I'm like, yeah. Got it hung up in my living room right now. So, praying about things you don't need. Oftentimes, you'd be praying about, I want a, you know, a sandcastle thing for my kid, and you're driving down the street, and somebody threw one out. You throw it to the top of your car, and you bring it home. It's like Christmas.